Today is April 2nd, and we are in John chapter 10, ostensibly at verse 22, which begins a brand new section of the book, at long last. Of course, when you consider what's left of John, and the fact that we know we're not going to finish this year, it's not the only section that's going to go a little slowly. That's okay. That's just because John runs deep sometimes. But you knew that. This new section is built around the Feast of Dedication. That's a feast we have not dealt with before. It's also a feast that is not in the Old Testament. So there's a little bit of background work to do. And to be honest, I think today will probably be a day for background work, because there's not only the background to the Feast of Dedication, to understand how Jesus is being portrayed by John against that feast's meaning, but there's also the fact that the previous section that we just finished actually serves as a direct background to this section. And this last half of chapter 10 that opens this section, it goes through 11 and 12, sets the stage and serves as something of a backdrop for what happens in chapters 11 and 12. And then before we get to the end of chapter 10, Jesus quotes Psalm 82, and that seems a little cryptic, so we may spend a little bit of time on the background of Psalm 82 as well. So it's Background Sunday here in the adult class. All right. Well, let's get into it. I said it's a brand new section. Remember, of course, that every section in John is built around a feast. Not all people who teach or write on John believe that. I'm in the minority, but I'm not alone. And it starts, if you want to count it as the first one, with the wedding feast at Cana, way back in chapter 2, where Jesus turns the water to wine, and where he is shown as the one who brings the new creation Sabbath with him. And then we had Passover for the first time in John, in chapters 2, 3, and 4, especially centered on Nicodemus. And Jesus is shown as the new locus of Yahweh's presence with his people. Yahweh's presence with his people used to be focused on the temple, and specifically the Holy of Holies. But in John 2, 3, and 4, Jesus is seen as replacing that, and he is now the focus of Yahweh's presence among his people. Then we had a Sabbath in chapter 5, an unidentified feast, but it makes sense for it to be a Sabbath for a number of reasons. And this is where Jesus healed the lame man at the pool of Siloam. And that became, if you've noticed since then, kind of a seminal event. His conversations with the Jewish leadership have often gone back to that day and that miracle. But that section shows us Jesus as the one who restores his people to enter fully into the new creation. Then we had another Passover in chapter 6 with a lot of difficult teaching, and a lot of people left Jesus when he started talking about drinking his blood and eating his flesh. But that was the feeding of the 5,000 as well, showing Jesus as the provider for his people. And then Tabernacles, which we've spent so much time in recently, chapter 7 through the first half of chapter 10, where Jesus is shown as the Good Shepherd, who leads his people. You had the water image, just like the water in the desert. You had the light image, not unlike the pillar of fire and cloud that led them through the desert. And you had the good shepherd image in chapter 9, after the healing of the blind man. And now we come to the Feast of Dedication, which has a more common name. Anybody know what it is? Hanukkah. This is Hanukkah. And as I said, it's a feast that you don't find in the Old Testament. It's a feast that was established only about 200 years before these events that we see in John. So we'll talk a little bit about why that feast was brought about. Maybe you know the story, but I'm guessing that not all of us do. So we'll deal with that just a little bit. I also want to say, perhaps first of all, that this section flows very directly out of the end of chapter 9, even though time has passed. We've moved from the Feast of Tabernacles to the Feast of Dedication. That means that we've moved from basically late September or October to December. It's been 2.5 months. But when the leadership approaches Jesus here in the first verses of this section, Jesus immediately picks up on the shepherd and sheep theme that he was using when he talked with them last time. So he makes a direct connection. And it makes sense for this to flow because, well, you tell me, when he was talking about the true shepherd, what is the characteristic? What is the characterizing mark of the true shepherd? I heard something. What? Exactly. The true shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And what is the hallmark miracle in this next section in John 11? Jesus is going to raise Lazarus from the dead. He will, and I'm giving some things away here, but you know me, I don't mind saying them twice. Okay, four times. As we move through this section, he will pull out of Jerusalem and he will go across the Jordan and he'll stay there. And then when he gets news about Lazarus, he will head back to Jerusalem, back to Judea at least. And the disciples think he's nuts because they want to kill him. But he goes anyway. So this whole section is about the true shepherd risking his life to save one lost sheep. It's very much an outgrowth of the whole true shepherd, good shepherd conversation that he just had with the leadership. All right. So John 10:22. I'm not even going to get through one verse before I stop and do more background work. At that time, the Feast of Dedication took place at Jerusalem. So what's the Feast of Dedication? It's Hanukkah. What is Hanukkah? What is it celebrating? Why is it so important if it wasn't even in the Old Testament? Well, anybody ever heard of the Maccabees and the Maccabee Revolt? That's the story behind Hanukkah and the Feast of Dedication. What's that?
Menorah.
Oh yes, the menorah is definitely part of this. The seven flamed candelabra, if you will. Usually there's actually an eighth flame, but that's the one that's used to light the other seven. Or is it eight and then the ninth one? Anyway. It's because of the menorah and a miracle that is said to have happened at the first Feast of Dedication, it came to be known as the Festival of Lights. And of course, if you remember, tabernacles, light is a major theme as well, with the torches in the court of the women. There are actually quite a few similarities outwardly between the Feast of Dedication and the Feast of Tabernacles. Well, back around 175 BC, so in round numbers, 200 years before Jesus' public ministry, Judea was part of what was called the Ptolemy Empire, or I guess kingdom is the technical term. The Ptolemies were the ruling family in Egypt, and Judea was part of that realm. They were under Egyptian government. But another family, another group, based out of Syria, the Seleucids, defeated the Ptolemies. And as part of the peace deal, they got Judea. And their king, Antiochus III, promised the Israelites that they would be free to worship, they would be free to hold their festivals and have their observances and their pilgrimages, and that would not be a problem. And it wasn't until Antiochus III died, and his son, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, came to the throne. Now, there's a lot of political machinations going on behind the scenes here, and I don't know that we need to get into all of them. But some exiled factions of Judaism that were in Syria had his ear, and they influenced him to crack down on Jerusalem and its surrounding areas. And he did, in some very remarkable and cruel ways. Let me just read something to you here. In 175 BC, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, the son of Antiochus III, invaded Judea at the request of the Tobiads. It's the group I mentioned, exiled faction of Judaism. The Tobiads had led the Hellenizing Jewish faction in Jerusalem. They had been expelled a few years earlier when the high priest Onias and his pro-Egyptian faction had taken over control from them. And Josephus writes about all of this. The king, being therefore disposed beforehand, complied with their request, and came upon the Jews with a great army, and took their city by force, and slew a great multitude of those that favored Ptolemy, and sent out his soldiers to plunder without mercy. He also spoiled the temple, and put a stop to the constant practice of offering a daily sacrifice of expiation. And he stopped that practice for 3.5 years. He also deposed the high priest and sold the high priesthood to his own brother, whose name was Joshua. He set up an altar to Zeus in the temple. He ordered that pigs be sacrificed in the temple. So he's doing things that are, he's going the extra mile to desecrate everything that the Jews hold dear. He's turning the temple into a pagan temple. He's slaughtering a forbidden animal and pouring that blood across the floor of the temple. There was a lot of torture that went on. If you read the books, particularly 1st and 2nd Maccabees, which is not in the Old Testament unless you have a Roman Catholic or an Eastern Orthodox Bible, and then you'll find it just before the Gospels. But it is in It's considered what they call the deuterocanonical books, which means they're sort of second tier. They're not considered to be divinely inspired by most Christian groups, but they are considered to be important and to have some historical significance and usefulness. So the story is there in the books of the Maccabees. Judaism was, in fact, outlawed 3 years later. That's when he had the altar to Zeus set up in the temple. And, of course, all of this provoked a revolt. Mattathias, a Jewish priest, and his five sons, Jochanan, Simeon, Eleazar, Jonathan, and Judah, led a rebellion against Antiochus. And by the way, the depth of the desecration that Antiochus committed and the fact that he stopped the daily offering for 3.5 years has led many scholars to believe that the very, very difficult prophecy in Daniel 9 about the prince who would have a strong covenant for 7 years and then would stop the sacrifices for 3.5, they think that that's Antiochus Epiphanes. Others think that that very difficult passage is referring to Jesus. Very, very different directions. Daniel 9 is the hardest little bit of translation there is in the Bible. It's not even Hebrew, it's Aramaic, and it makes it a little bit extra challenge. But you've got that 3.5 years that's associated with Antiochus Epiphanes, of course. But you've also got 3.5 years that's associated with Jesus. That's his public ministry. And so you can see reasons to try to pin that prophecy in either direction, but my goodness, one of them is the polar opposite of the other. It's also ironic because the name Epiphanes means the one manifested by God, and his brother, to whom he sold the high priesthoods, his name was Joshua, which is just another form of the name Jesus. So there's a lot of ironies here, where this great evil has some names that are very much associated with Messiah himself 200 years later. Anyway, Mattathias and his sons led a rebellion against Antiochus. It started with Mattathias killing a couple of people, but he died a year or two later, and his son Judah took over. But because of the way that he led the revolt with such boldness, he was called Judah the Hammer, which in Hebrew is Judah HaMaccabi. So that's where the name Maccabee comes from. It means hammer. There's a number of battles involved. I don't need to get into all of that. But within a couple of years, they had liberated the temple and rededicated it. And the festival of Hanukkah was instituted to celebrate that rededication and that victory over the great evil of Antiochus Epiphanes. The reason the menorah, by the way, this is not really part of the lesson for John 10, but the reason the menorah became so important and the reason that it became known as the Festival of Lights is that according to at least legend, when they had rededicated the temple and set everything back up to have it run the way it was supposed to, and they established this feast, they said that just like tabernacles, they would keep the flame going for 8 days. And they quickly found that they didn't have enough oil to do that. They only had enough oil to keep it burning for 1 day or night. But they went ahead and used it, and miraculously, that one night's worth of oil lasted for the whole 8. And so that miracle, whether it really happened or not, so miracle or legend, became the background for that becoming such an important part of the feast, and why the menorah has such an important role, and why it came to be known as the Festival of Lights. But fundamentally, it is a festival that celebrates the rededication of the temple. So there is a question that's a fair one to ask, although I think John makes it pretty obvious. can we talk about Jesus fulfilling this feast when it isn't even a feast of the Torah? Well, John certainly is devoting a section to it, so I think we can. And then, of course, the question will, as it always is, be how does Jesus then fulfill this feast of dedication? And we'll take that apart as we go. All right? Yeah?
Just a quick question. It's a little bit of a side thing, but what actually is Torah then? I mean, we're talking as if it's a physical thing, which most Jews would say. But doesn't this make the Feast of Dedication Torah?
Doesn't what make the Feast of Dedication Torah?
The fact that it's referred to with full provenance and celebrated.
Okay, yeah, then I get what you're saying. Doesn't the fact that it came to have such a role in the life of God's people authenticate it and could not be considered Torah even if it's not part of the original writings?
Not just the life of God's people, but in the life of Christ and his disciples.
I guess it does depend on how you want to define Torah. There is a distinction that's made sometimes where the things that are actually written are called the Gemara. And there are other distinctions, too. I mean, some people talk about Torah, and they're talking about the five books of Moses. Others, and this is just within Judaism, talk about Torah, and they're talking about the entire Tanakh, the entire Old Testament, including the prophets and the Psalms and the wisdom writings. So, yeah, there's a little bit of fuzziness around the edges of how you define Torah. I'm not concerned about whether this should be considered part of Torah. It's obviously considered part of how Jesus reveals himself. And that's enough for me, for our purposes. I don't know if that answers your question. Maybe it sidesteps it, but...
No, it answers it. But the root of the question for me has always come down to the same question of canon. And that Maccabees... to me, because of this citation, holds a different place than the rest of the apocryphal books.
Oh, okay.
That's really what the root is. But I didn't want to go that far afield.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah. To me, that's a fair argument to make. I look at this, and I think that it gives us a precedent to try to interpret Jesus in terms of the culture that we're speaking to, even if that's a culture that doesn't share the Jewish backgrounds. And of course, that's something that the church has had to do ever since. But John himself does it. Any other thoughts or questions about Hanukkah and what's going on with this feast? It's a detailed history. As I said, I'm not going to get into all those details. It's an interesting read. Understand, too, that it was only 200 years before Jesus. It had only resolved itself a little bit less than that. It's not much different than the distance between us today and the Civil War. It's about 160 years. So, if you think about how the Civil War plays, even today, and it does, there are still North-South distinctions. There are still North-South cultural differences. There are still some North-South prejudices. There was the whole mess in the last 2 years with efforts to outlaw the Confederate flag, for example. There's a lot of things that still go on in our culture that have their roots back in the Civil War. Well, there's a lot of things going on in Jesus' day that have their roots back in the Maccabean Revolt and the experience with Antiochus Epiphanes. I think it's one of the reasons why they have some concerns about some of the things Jesus says, because they remember some of the things that were happening back then. And we can talk about that as we get deeper into the section. it ties into things that we brought out before about how there, and we're going to see that actually explicitly stated very soon in John, where they are afraid that if this gets out of hand, if his movement and his followers continue to grow, that Rome is going to intervene. And part of that plays into the fears of what had happened back then, even though Rome per se was not involved back then. The dynamics were similar. All right, so that's some background on the Feast of Dedication. The key thing to remember is that it is commemorating the rededication of the temple when it was cleansed of the desecrations and abominations that had been set up there and restored to what God had intended for it. All right. So at that time, the Feast of Dedication took place at Jerusalem. It was winter, it was December, and Jesus was walking in the temple in the colonnade of Solomon, which in many ways is neither here nor there for the story, but the Feast of Dedication focuses on the temple, and the colonnade of Solomon is an interesting detail to mention because it does subtly increase that focus on the temple. The colonnade of Solomon was a structure that ran down the east edge, north to south. It ran down the east side of the temple grounds. It was original. Solomon had, in fact, built it along with the first temple. When Herod, when the first temple was destroyed, they didn't destroy the colonnade. When Herod rebuilt the temple, the second temple, or Herod's temple, which is the temple that we have at the time of Jesus, Herod also redid a lot of other things. And he didn't build the walls for the courtyard everywhere they had been before. He expanded them out a bit in many places. But he did not touch Solomon's colonnade. And according to historians, the reason he didn't was money. It was the most elaborate structure on the edges of the courtyard. It was two walls, and between those two walls, the lines of columns, and that was just a lot to try to rebuild or restore, and he left it alone. So we have this one piece of the original temple grounds that's still standing, and that's where Jesus is. Possibly because it's chilly outside. Maybe that's why John mentions it being winter, but it's neither here nor there, really. So the Jews, that is the Jewish leadership again, gathered around him and said to him, "How long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly." There's a lot of interesting things in those couple of sentences. First is, how long will you keep us in suspense? If you've studied a foreign language, it might not surprise you to know that this is a very idiomatic statement. I mean, even the statement in English, how long will you keep us in suspense? How long will you keep us dangling? That is an idiomatic statement itself. But the Jewish statement here, the Hebrew, can be translated a couple of ways if you translate it literally. One is, how long will you lift up our soul? Which might relate more to, in English, how long will you keep us up in the air? And the other way that it could be translated in Hebrew is, how long or until when will you take our life? Which is kind of tempting to think about in terms of all the ironies that are about to happen in terms of them taking his life and then their lives being taken 40 years later at the fall of Jerusalem. But fundamentally, it's an idiomatic phrase, and it's translated correctly. How long are you going to keep us in suspense? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly. If you are Messiah, just say so. Doesn't that sound like a reasonable request? But it isn't. Because if he accedes to what they're asking and says, yes, I am Messiah, they'll kill him. They've already said, and John has already reported, that anyone who professed him as Messiah would be thrown out of the synagogue, banned from Judaism. If they could get him to flat out say, yes, I am Messiah, they could do the same to him, although they would do much worse. They would kill him. Because that's what they do to people who claim to be Messiah. Which is really kind of a self-defeating mechanism if you really think Messiah is coming someday. But there we are.
How many people have declared themselves to be Messiah?
You know, it was a known phenomenon in the last couple hundred years.
I think about 30 or 40 years before Christ, there was a big revolt in of a guy that claimed to be Messiah.
Yeah, and there would be another one or two after, before the destruction of Jerusalem. Yeah, it happened a few times. It happened a few times. I always get stuck in my head the lyrics of the Eagles song, Learn to Be Still. We're all like sheep without a shepherd. We don't know how to be alone. So we wander around this desert, keep on following the wrong gods home. The flock cries out for another, and they keep answering that bell. So one more starry-eyed Messiah meets his final farewell. That's kind of what was going on back then, every few years. So if you are the Christ, tell us plainly. If you are Messiah, just say so. And Jesus answered them, I did tell you. He doesn't just flat out say, yes, I am Messiah. He says, I told you, and you don't believe. The works that I do in my Father's name bear witness about me. Now, there's a statement that was made here. It was made back with the healing of the blind man. It was made back with the healing of the lame man in chapter 5. That's where it really got started. Although you could trace it back even farther to Nicodemus. We know that God is with you because of the signs that we see you perform. The works that I do in my Father's name bear witness about me. Verse 26, but you do not believe because you are not among my sheep. And that is where he ties it directly back to the conversation he was having with them just a couple months earlier after the healing of the blind man. Where we said even then that what he had to say there had as much to say about false sheep as it did about false shepherds. And here it is again. He's not calling them false shepherds. He's saying they're not part of his sheep. You do not believe because you are not among my sheep. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. And can I just give this away one more time? This is going to be all about the raising of Lazarus. My sheep hear my voice. Lazarus, come forth. And I know them and they follow me. And Lazarus came out. So that's coming. And these verses apply very well to it. My sheep hear my voice and I know them and they follow me. Of course, the implication here in the moment is, you are not hearing me, and I don't know you, and you are not following me. Verse 28, I give them eternal life, which is another theme that we've seen over and over, and they will never perish. And no one will snatch them out of my hand. My Father, who has given them to me, is greater than all. and no one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hand. I and the Father are one. And their immediate response, they pick up stones again to stone him. Not the first time. Not the last time. And Jesus says to them, hey, wait a minute. I have shown you many good works. From the Father. Because that's all he does, right? The Son does what the Father does. And he's here because the Father sent him. And he's doing the will of the Father. So I have shown you many good works from the Father. For which of them are you going to stone me? Are you going to stone me because I healed a blind man? Because I healed a lame man? Because I fed a multitude? They probably don't know about walking on the water and calming the storm. That was one that just the disciples saw. But it doesn't really matter, because their answer is, it's not for a good work that we're going to stone you, but for blasphemy. Because you, being a man, make yourself God. Well, it's not the first time they've said that either. They said that back in chapter 5. You're equating yourself to God. And this really is... Yeah, Linda.
Sorry, are you reading from the New King James?
I'm reading from the English Standard.
Oh, okay. Well, it sounds sort of King James.
A little bit. They put a little bit of flair to it, yeah.
That's my favorite.
They had wanted to stone him back in chapter 5 for the same thing. And this is the problem that they have. This is the tension that is causing the division within the Jewish leadership. The works tell them one thing, and Jesus keeps pointing them that way. But the words, they either don't understand or can't accept. So here they want to stone him, not for the works, but for the words. Just thinking back to the prologue, the Word became flesh, and they didn't understand it. And it's true, they don't understand the Word that is Christ, and they don't understand the Word that Christ is speaking. So it's not for the good works that they want to stone him, but for blasphemy, because being a man, he has made himself God. And then Jesus quotes Psalm 82 at them. Jesus answered them, "Is it not written in your law, I said you are gods?" That's Psalm 82:6. If he called them gods to whom the word of God came, and scripture can't be broken, do you say of him whom the Father consecrated and sent into the world, you are blaspheming because I said I am the Son of God? If I'm not doing the works of my Father, then don't believe me. But if I do them, even though you do not believe me, believe the works, that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I am in the Father. I really am hearing this as not so much confrontation this time, although there's some of that, as we'll see, because the background to Psalm 82 is a little bit of a knife in the ribs. But he's also kind of pleading with them. You're ignoring the works and focusing on words that you can't handle. Ignore the words. Don't worry about the words. If you can't figure that part out, ignore it. Look at the works. Look at the works. They testify to me, as he said any number of times. If you don't believe me, believe the works, that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I am in the Father. Again, they sought to arrest him, but he escaped from their hands. All right, why does he quote that strange statement, I said you are gods? Well, let's take a look at Psalm 82. It is not very long. It's also not a psalm of David, it's a psalm of Asaph. But that's neither here nor there. Psalm 82, God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. Well, that almost makes it sound polytheistic, doesn't it? Like there's a whole bunch of gods, and they're all sitting around the round table of the heavens, making decisions. But that's not what this is. The divine council is something else. God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Give justice to the weak and the fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. They have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. I said, you are gods, sons of the Most High, all of you. Nevertheless, like men, you shall die and fall like any prince. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for you shall inherit all nations. So, who is he talking to and about here? I said, you are gods, sons of the Most High. And they are exercising judgment over God's people, and he's upset with them because they're favoring the wicked, and they're not helping the weak and the needy and the poor and the destitute the way that they're supposed to. Who is he talking about here? He's talking about the judges of Israel. They share God's authority. It's a derivative authority. They derive it from Yahweh. They share his authority to judge the people. Nothing unusual about that. David, as the model king of Israel's history, is very clearly depicted as having derived authority from Yahweh. Psalm 110 would give you an example of that if you want to look it up. I'm not going to go there. But David's own story in Samuel and Chronicles does the same thing. So these gods, these people that he's calling gods, are men. They're human beings. They're the judges of Israel who are sharing his authority to rule over the people. How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Give justice to the weak and the fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. And at that point, I think suddenly he's not talking about those who need help anymore. At verse 5, I think he starts talking about the judges themselves. They have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken because they are not doing what they're supposed to do on Yahweh's behalf and in Yahweh's name. So I said, you are God, sons of the Most High, all of you. Nevertheless, you shall die like men and fall like any prince, like any leader. So Psalm 82 is an indictment of the judges of Israel who are exercising their office in a corrupt way. Does this sound at all familiar? I hope so. Just the previous chapter. We were just doing this last week. John 9. The true shepherd and the false shepherds. They're supposed to be concerned about the lost sheep. But when they have a lost sheep right in front of them in the form of this man born blind, do they help him? No. They revile him. And they boot him out. And they won't help the ones who need it. So when he cites Psalm 82 here, this again, just like the sheep and shepherd language that he's picked up that ties directly back to their conversation 2 months ago and just a few verses ago, so does this. Citing Psalm 82 ties right back to the conversation he had with them at the first part of chapter 10, end of 9, first part of 10, that ends that last section, the true shepherd. Ties right back to that. He is still indicting them. In an interesting way, because he's citing Psalm 82 to legitimize using God language of a child of Israel. But at the same time, the context of Psalm 82 is another jab at the way they're not doing their job. Does that make sense? And if they're as learned as they are supposed to be, which is sometimes not entirely clear, but if they're as learned as they're supposed to be, somebody in that crowd understands the jab. But that's why Psalm 82 is cited here. Because there is a place where someone can talk about men being gods in their own scriptures, also because it still reflects everything Jesus has been saying to them about the bad job they're doing. Which of my works will you stone me for? None of them. We're not even worried about the works. We're worried about what you're saying. So this conflict continues. This tension continues. And as I said last time, it hardly seems like it can get worse, but it will. And this is the section where it's going to get worse. So, verse 40. Since they sought to arrest him, but he escaped from their hands, he went away again across the Jordan to the place where John had been baptizing at first. And there he remained. So it's come back full circle. And he's withdrawn from Jerusalem and withdrawn from Judea because there's a price on his head, basically. But that doesn't end the dedication of the temple theme that runs through the next couple of chapters. And verse 41, many came to him. And they said, John did no sign. But everything that John, this is John the Baptist, of course, everything that John said about this man was true. And many believed in him there. Very likely that the people who are coming to him, at least initially, once word gets out that he's there, are the locals, and they would have been there for John the Baptist's sermons and messages as well. So, an easy comparison for them to make. John didn't perform any signs, but this guy has. But everything that John said about this man was true, and many believed in him there. Notice that now it does not say many Jews or many of the Jews. It just says and many in both 41 and 42. So now we're talking about the general populace. We're not talking about the Jewish leadership. He's gaining more followers out there at the Jordan. And that is its own problem. Remember that back in chapter 4, I guess it would have been, he was at the Jordan, not too far from where John had been working, and his disciples were doing baptisms. And he left there, and he headed north, and he went through Samaria, and that's where he came across the woman at the well. But why did he leave and head north? Because he heard that the Pharisees had found out that his ministry was growing. And before they came out to see him at the Jordan, he withdrew and headed north to Galilee. So he was here before, and when he was here before, his ministry was growing, and it was causing a problem for the Jewish leadership. Now he's back, and it's just more of the same. Many are believing in him, and it's going to cause a problem with the leadership. Except this time, they're not going to come out. This time, he's going to go back into their territory in order to raise Lazarus. Because, as I said before, the true shepherd, the good shepherd, risks his life for the sheep. And that's just exactly what he is acting out with this whole business about Lazarus' death. And that's the sense in which this first bit of the new section serves as background for the rest of it. Because it's all about him being a good and true shepherd. But it's also about the Feast of Dedication. And we'll see how as we go along. Make sense? It'll make more sense later. That's how John is. Other thoughts or questions? Yeah.
Any historical evidence that Lazarus was then killed? I mean, he was risen from the dead, but then the Jews were out to get him as well. Because of the rising, did they manage to kill him?
Is there any historical evidence about what happened to Lazarus after he was raised? No, there's not. There are early church traditions, but they're not well attested. They're not documented. And you and I both know from our shared time in the Eastern Orthodox tradition that there's a lot of things there that are held as true that aren't well documented and are really just traditions and legends. And that's one of them. But any thoughts about what actually ultimately happened to Lazarus? The one thing that any... I want to say this right, correctly. The one thing that the existing traditions do hold to is that they did not succeed in killing him. But we really don't know. But you're right, and we will see that later. They not only plot to kill Jesus, they plot to kill Lazarus. Because you also need to destroy the evidence. Anybody else? We'll call it there. It's 10:15. And I don't want to get started in chapter 11 because that is the Lazarus story. And better to just start that fresh next week. All right? All right. Then let us close with prayer. I will say this much more, and it's given away a little bit, but I've been giving away a little bit about Lazarus all day anyway. This is an observation that we made several weeks ago, even a few months ago, that in the structure of John, the raising of Lazarus is the point where they say, we've got to kill Jesus. Well, actually, they've been plotting to kill him at other times too. But that's where it really gets serious. And if you look at the other three Gospels, it's not the raising of Lazarus that leads them to say, we've got to kill this guy. It's the cleansing of the temple in Matthew, Mark, and Luke that leads the leadership to say, we've got to kill this guy. And that seems like a contradiction, because John puts the cleansing of the temple much earlier. And we talked about that back when he did it. There can have been two cleansings. There wasn't as much of a concern. His ministry hadn't gone as far. He wasn't as much of a danger at that point early in his ministry. So he could have cleansed the temple more than once. But the other thing that deserves to be said, and this is exactly why everything here in this section fits directly into the theme of the Feast of Dedication, which is all about cleansing the temple, right? Raising Lazarus from the dead, overcoming the effect of sin that had led to his death, is its own form of cleansing a temple. Because we are temples. And Jesus is explicit in saying that, and so are the other New Testament writers. And so if Hanukkah is all about purging an abomination and a desecration out of the temple and cleansing it and rededicating it, the raising of Lazarus is exactly that. It's just a temple not made with hands. But it is the temple that's going to get all of the focus in the church age, because the brick and mortar temple's coming down. That's why this section ties into the theme of temple dedication or rededication. It has everything to do with a different temple than Herod's. All right, let's pray. Father, thank you that you have made your people into your temple, into your dwelling place on the earth. Grant that we would be worthy of that, and that we would be humbled by it, and that we would be inspired by it to live a life worthy of your presence in us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.